law school. It's an investment in your future. But like all investments, without the right advice, it can lead to disaster. That's where Pre-Law Pro comes in. Whether you're exploring the law, navigating the admissions process, or need personalized career guidance, at Pre-Law Pro, we've got your back. Don't gamble on your future. Invest in it. Get started today at prelawpro.com.
How can I make myself more competitive?
How do I build my network?
I want my career to go to the next level, but I don't really know where to start.
I hate the job I am in. What else can I do?
I want to work in healthcare, but I don't want to be a doctor.
I need connections in a new industry. Where should I start?
Whether you're a college student trying to decide on a career path, a young professional trying to develop their career, or maybe you're in the mid to late stages of your own professional journey and you're looking for a new challenge, or maybe you're facing an unexpected job search. Whoever you are, wherever you are, welcome to the Professionists Podcast. And together, let's find your fit.
Welcome, folks, to another episode of the Professionists Podcast. In this week's episode, we have Colonel Sparky Matthews, which I've got to ask you how you got the name Sparky. But Colonel Matthews is started out his career as a U.S. Air Force flight surgeon and ultimately went on to become the first Surgeon General of the U.S. Space Force. Sparky, thank you so much for joining us.
That's my pleasure, Ben. Thank you.
We obviously talked about in the introduction the extent of your military and medical career, but let's take a step back. As 17, 18-year-old, why did you decide to even pursue medicine? Like, what was it that drew you to that profession?
Well, it goes far back quite a bit further than 17 years old. I never remember wanting to do anything but be a physician. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, all the way from 6, 7, 8 years old, I wanted to be a doctor. And I don't know that I could tell you why, other than it's been a calling that I've had literally my entire life.
I feel like that's a fairly common sense because pre-med is such a heavily pursued career path. You're currently at Baylor University and it's known for having a ton of pre-med students. What is the difference between the people who have a passion and make it and the people who perhaps have a passion and don't ultimately go on to a medical career?
Oh, that is such a great question. So when I teach first-year seminars for pre-med students at Baylor. And what I tell them, and I meet with each one of them individually, is I tell them, first of all, that medicine is an amazing thing to do, but if you can imagine doing anything else and being happy, you should think about that and thinking about doing that other thing instead, because the road of training for medicine is so long and so difficult. And not everybody makes it. And so if medicine is just what you hit when you threw a dart at the dartboard and it sounded good, then I say you really need to think about doing something else. But regardless, the commitment and the calling that an undergraduate student has, I tell every one of them, what is your plan B? Because you have to think about plan B for medicine and for everything else in your life as well. Because we never plan to fail, we only fail to plan. Eisenhower said that. And so I have them tell me what they want to do instead of medicine if that time comes that they realize that they either can't or don't want to pursue medicine. And what I often hear is, I've never thought about that before. Well, that's a good answer. You still need to come up with an alternative plan. But that tells me that that person is committed. If an individual says, well, medicine sounds good, but also thought about engineering or being a teacher or studying philosophy, that tells me that person probably needs to do that other thing. And it's not because they can't do medicine. It's because they shouldn't, because it takes such a commitment over such a long time. And that's the other thing that I tell my students is just because you want to be a physician doesn't mean you get to be a physician. And just because you can be a physician doesn't mean you should be. So it's calling and capability. And then there's some grit thrown in there too.
Well, it's funny because one of the reasons this podcast came about is because so many people, when they're thinking, what does a successful career look like? They have this really short list of professions, medicine, law, few others that kind of fall into that short list. And I think it's perhaps even more pronounced amongst people who are coming to college for the first time. No one else in their family has had that experience. And so even if you haven't thought about anything else other than being a doctor, that's a great time in your life to be able to explore some other career paths, because even within healthcare, there are so many career paths where you can make good money, but also genuinely make an impact in a meaningful way and really be involved in the science of medicine.
Sure, absolutely. And you asked you mentioned a question there at the beginning of what you said, that what does a successful career look like? And I can answer that question the way I've answered it to young officers in the Air Force, to undergraduate students. And the answer to that question is doing the best job you can in the job you have today. And if you do that, the people that are in your career field will find opportunities for you to advance. Because when I looked at young officers, when I look at young physicians and undergraduate students now, the person that's more concerned about their next job than their current job is not a person that I help succeed. It's the individual that does the best job they can today, because I know they're going to do that in their next job and the next job after that and the next job after that. That's the successful person. And you can see them all the way from 18 years old.
I guess this is actually probably a good place to jump into a relationship that you had in college that really changed the direction of your life. We talk a lot on this podcast about the importance of networking, about reaching out to people outside of your existing network, but also the importance of those relationships being invested in so that they might ultimately, not all of them, but a key number of them will turn into mentors who then turn into sponsors. You had a really key mentor in college. How did that come about? What kind of difference did it make?
I did. And my mentor's name was Dr. Bill Hillis. He was a professor at Baylor, taught upper-level biology courses for pre-med students. He was a physician. And he has a very colorful life. And I would encourage anyone listening to go Google search Dr. William Hillis just to see everything that he did. But Dr. Hillis was, I was taking one of his courses the spring of my senior year, and I was already accepted to medical school. And he announced that there was an Air Force and an Army medical recruiter on campus that day, and that that's how he had gone through medical school. And so he encouraged anyone interested to go talk to him. And I didn't give that a second thought. But as I left the room, he reached out and grabbed me by the shoulder. And he said, "You really should go talk to the Air Force recruiter, because I think it would be a great fit for you. And in flight medicine, I think would be something you might be interested in." And that was good enough for me. And I went straight over to the office where the recruiter was, and the rest, as they say, is history. 28 years later, I retired from the Air Force. And Dr. Hillis, he and I became very good friends over the course of the rest of his life. In fact, 25 years later, he came to my colonel's promotion ceremony with his wife. So that tells you what kind of mentor he became to me. But I asked him multiple times over the years, "Dr. Hillis, why did you, what made you reach out to me?" Because he didn't do that to anyone else in class as we left. And he said, "You know what? I couldn't tell you. I couldn't tell you. I was led by the Spirit. That was just something I was supposed to do." And I'll tell you that the man set the course of my entire life. And with a 20-second interaction with me, he didn't just change my life. He set the course of my life. And he is still touching students today because I came back to Baylor to be Bill Hillis to a new generation of pre-med students.
So did you know him well before that brief interaction, that 20-second interaction?
Not at all. I knew him as my professor. I knew him because he was the vice president of student life at Baylor. And I'd heard stories about him, but I don't know that I had personally interacted with him. How he knew to reach out to me, I can only leave in the Lord's hands, because there's no other explanation that he or I could come up with.
So having had the benefit of that brief interaction and the trajectory that it put you on, you must have had other mentors throughout the course of your professional life, and I'm sure that you've had the opportunity to mentor other people. How did you go about finding those mentor relationships? Because I think for a lot of people, it sounds great on paper, but they don't know where to start.
Sure. Well, there's really two ways that a person can become a mentor Well, two ways that you can find a mentor, and there's different ways to become a mentor. As far as finding mentors, some of those individuals are naturally placed in your path. The most important mentor that I've ever had in my entire life was my father, Wayne Matthews. He taught me most of what I know about leadership before I left to go to college. I discovered those lessons later in life. As I said, that's what Dad was talking about. But my residency program director, Dr. Romy Richardson, was a mentor that, because he was my program director, that was a natural person to look to. But it's more than just crossing paths with someone. An individual has to be willing to be a mentor. And then the person on the receiving end, and I'm going to call him a mentee. I don't know if that's an actual word, but that's what I'll call it. The mentee has to be willing to accept that mentoring. A mentoring relationship really is a two-way street. So one has to be willing to give and the other has to be willing to receive. Now, mentors receive from their mentees as well, because the kids that I mentor, they energize me like nothing else. And they really show, they give me so much satisfaction with what I'm doing. But as far as how a person becomes a mentor, really it's as simple as putting it out there and letting the people that are within your sphere of influence that are walking the path that you're further down, just putting it out there that, I love to mentor. I'm willing to be a mentor. If you would like to come and talk with me and engage with that and see if you'd like to have a mentoring relationship, come talk to me. And then you just wait.
I was going to say, as someone who mentors a lot of people, what kind of approach would be a good one for someone to take? So let's say a student is taking some of your classes and they think, you know what, Dr. Matthews would be a really awesome person to have as my mentor.
Sure.
You obviously are super keen to mentor people, but if you were not in an education setting, how would you encourage somebody who wants a mentor to go about soliciting a mentor?
That's a great question. So my experience is in the military and academia. Mm-hmm. And so it's very easy in those two environments to see the people that are ahead of you that are further down the road. My boss, my boss's boss. It's best not to look too high in the organization for a mentor. Somebody that gets hired in the mailroom probably doesn't need to be going to the COO or CEO and asking for a mentoring relationship. But maybe not the mailroom supervisor, but maybe that person's supervisor. Find someone that is where you think you want to go and engage them and say, you can send them an email. That's a relatively sterile and easy way to do that. Send them an email and say, hey, let me introduce myself. Here's who I am. Don't make it too long because then they'll just stop reading.
Yeah.
But send them an email and say, this is who I am. I'm new to the organization, or this is what I do in the organization. I'm looking for ways to get better at what I do. And you are someone that has clearly been successful. Would you have time for me to sit down and talk with you? And anyone that's in a leadership position in an organization that's worthy of you pursuing as a mentor knows exactly what that means when they receive an email like that. So I get emails from students all the time, people I've never even heard of. It'll say, hey, this so-and-so told me about you. My roommate took your class. I want to be a doctor. This is who I am. Is there a time that we could maybe meet or whatever? And without exception, I tell them yes.
Yeah.
Even if it's not going to result in a mentoring relationship, you don't make any calls, you don't make any sales.
Yeah.
And so I meet with every student.
That's fantastic. Let's take a little bit of a jump from the mentoring and the college experience. I think a lot of people have a pretty decent sense of civilian medicine in the sense that it's in television, it's in the movies. We, by and large, all go to the doctor at some point, hopefully fairly regularly, but civilian medicine is fairly clear in our minds. But space and aviation medicine and medicine in these harsh environments seems like a very different kettle of fish.
Sure.
What are some of the big differences?
Yeah. So when people ask me, as an aerospace medicine specialist, they say, what is that?
Yeah.
And I say, well, first of all, it's the greatest job in the universe, being a flight surgeon, because you get to be a physician for pilots and their families. You get to fly. You get to be a part of their world. And it's really great. But the discipline of aerospace medicine, the best way to describe it, every other discipline of medicine, whether it's pediatrics or oncology, general surgery, whatever, is dealing with abnormal physiology in a normal environment. Okay, so if you go to the doctor, you're going to expect the inside of the exam room to be roughly the same temperature, pressure, oxygen saturation as your car as you were driving there. Aerospace medicine is normal physiology in an abnormal environment. Okay, other physicians repair broken engines. Flight surgeons tune them up and turn them into muscle cars and then send them out onto a racetrack. Okay, so what I deal with as a flight surgeon is selected healthy people. So aviators are, by definition, except for maybe astronauts, the healthiest group of people in the world because we select them for their health. And so I look at those healthy individuals, and then I look at the environment they're in. It's low pressure at altitude. It's high altitude. It's low temperature. There's increased vibration. There is decreased oxygen saturation in the air. And there's high pressure tasks that they're required to deal with. And this can be anything from somebody flying airlift where they're flying cargo to somebody that is putting warheads on foreheads in an F-16. So dealing with their mission, their environment, and making sure that their physical, that they maintain their physical capabilities. And when they do have illness, that illness is not inconsistent with them continuing to fly. So let's say if you and I were to get a cold, just a standard upper respiratory virus, we're going to cough, we're going to get a runny nose, we're not going to feel very well for a couple of days, and we're probably still going to go about our business. If a pilot has a runny nose, then as the pressure decreases and increases and volumes expand and contract, they can get an ear block or a sinus block that can rupture their eardrum or literally tear the mucosal layer away from the bone in their sinuses.
Gosh.
And so something that is relatively innocuous for you or I on the ground is entirely different from them. Flight surgeons exist, so pilots don't have to think about that. They assess themselves in the morning, am I right or am I not right? And if they're not right, they come see me. And then I figure out all the rest for them. So that's really what aerospace medicine does.
So it sounds like that initial consultation happens on the ground, but are you also up in the air? So for example, in episode one of our first season, we interviewed Lieutenant Colonel Jeff Price, who was a navigator in the B-1s.
Right.
So did your role also involve you being in the air?
Yes. So flight surgeons in the Air Force are required to fly 4 hours a month to maintain our currency. And when we fly in the status of what we call an additional crew member. So I didn't have any aircraft control and navigation duties. I was basically there to interact with the pilots, to engage in their flight environment, and most importantly, to be a part of their community, because the physician is the natural enemy of the pilot.
Yeah.
And they would say that even before I did. So for instance, I need to understand what a pilot has to do in the aircraft. Give you an example. So flying T-38s, which is our fighter trainer in my first assignment in Del Rio, Texas at Laughlin Air Force Base, I had a pilot that had a twisted ankle, not a big deal, still walk on it, put him in a little lace-up boot, but the T-38's brakes are not hydraulic. Well, they have some hydraulic assist, but you have to get on those brakes and push hard on either side to make the aircraft stop. If you push harder on one side than the other, those pedals are also your steering pedals. So if you push harder on one side than the other, you're going off the runway to one side. And so I had flown the T-38. I knew what was involved in every aspect of flight. So knowing that, I said, you know what? Let's go to the flight simulator, and I want you to do a couple of takeoffs and landings, and I want to see you brake. And sure enough, he was braking three times as hard on the left as he was capable on the right, and he was departing the runway every time. So he didn't fly for a couple of weeks until that was resolved. And so without being in the aviation environment, without flying with my pilot, I wouldn't have understood that.
What does a shift, for want of a better word, look like? Because planes are up in the air for hours and hours, sometimes refueling in the air. Mm-hmm. Are you kind of constantly, like on a B-1, are you constantly going around and monitoring vital signs and checking on the team, or are you doing experiments, or like what does a shift look like?
So that's a great thing about being a flight surgeon is you do something different every day. So in an average, like in an F-16 squadron, a fighter squadron, so basically you have clinic 5 days a week. On the weekends, one of the docs is on call. But let's say 2 or 2.5 of those days during the week, I would see clinics. So scheduled patients coming in, pilots and their families. Some of that is occupational medicine as well. Maybe one of those days I'm doing administrative tasks, or half a day where I'm writing air medical waivers, doing medical evaluation boards, just kind of the administrivia that we do. I don't want to go into all the details with that. One day would be spent doing shop visits. So going out to inspect the life support shop where they work on the ejection seats, maybe doing a food service visit at the Burger King on base, going to the barber shop, making sure that they're keeping their sanitary standards. And then one of those 5 days I'm flying. So any air crew member has to have 12 hours of crew rest before they fly. So essentially, before you come into work, you have to be completely off of work and resting for 12 hours. That includes sleeping the night before. And so you can't, it's not like we work a full day in clinic and then go jump in the aircraft and fly. We have to follow the same rules that flyers do. So we really dedicate that day to flying when we do that. So when you go fly, in the F-16, you may get 1 to 1.5 hours of flying, but it's an entire day's ordeal. And so you're showing up early, you're talking to the pilots, you're going to the flight rooms, talking to folks at the desk. And I wasn't there with a stethoscope and blood pressure cuff. Although I had those with me, they just weren't hanging around my neck. But I'd go, and everyone knew that when Doc was in the squadron, if you had a problem, if you wanted to talk to the doc, just I was there. And I would hang around after the flight to do the same thing. And I'll tell you that fighter squadron, I did a lot more medicine on a bar stool than I did in my exam room.
Yeah.
Because you'd have a pilot come up and sit down and say, hey, doc, I've got this friend. He's got this problem. Well, and we'd work through that until we figured out what was going on.
Yeah.
But it was what a lot of people would call the ministry of presence. It's just being there and being available and having the trust of your air crew so they know they can come talk to you.
What's the residency process like for something like this? Because I think residency has a reputation as being extremely grueling, if not brutal, where you've got to have these rests and you've got to have some physical requirements before you can get up in the air. What did the residency look like for you in aerospace medicine?
Right. So the best way to describe this, there are three flavors of flight surgeon in the Air Force. There's the slick wing, the residency trained, and the aerospace medicine specialist. So the vast majority of flight docs in the Air Force have done medical school. They've completed a 1-year internship, which is where you really get beat to death. Has nothing to do with flight medicine. It's just, it's either general surgery, internal medicine, a rotational internship, whatever. And then they go out and serve as a flight doc for 2 years after going to the aerospace medicine primary school to get their wings, where you learn the basics of being a flight surgeon. So those are full physicians, licensed physicians, but they don't have any residency training beyond internship. And they're the workhorses of aerospace medicine. Young guys, young gals, I mean, they are the ones that get out there and can pull the 9Gs and the F-16, not like us old guys. So the second flavor is the residency trained flight surgeon. And that's someone that is trained, that has done an internship, done a residency in something like family medicine, emergency medicine, psychiatry, pediatrics, really anything. And then they go serve as a flight surgeon after their residency training is over. Okay. You don't have to do that forever. It's just as long as you want to. And those are the individuals that provide the medical expertise to our young flight docs that are the slick wings. And they kind of oversee the medicine of the clinic. Then there's the aerospace medicine specialist, which is what I am. And that is an individual that has completed the residency in aerospace medicine, or the RAM is what we call it. And so my track, I did an internship. I did 2 years as service as a slick wing flight doc, and then went to the residency in aerospace medicine. That residency is 3 years. The first year is your master's of public health, because a lot of flight medicine is population-based health. You're responsible for immunizations and food safety, housing quality, all of those things for the base. And then the second 2 years are aerospace medicine. You have some didactic, you have some clinical practice in the aerospace medicine consult service for the Air Force. And then when you come out on the end, typically the entry level is the chief of aerospace medicine for an entire base. So you're overseeing all of the medicine that's practiced for the pilots and everything that happens outside of the clinic walls.
Does that take you out of clinical practice and put you more in a managerial position?
To a certain extent, it does. So a chief of aerospace medicine, oversees several aspects of the mission, usually dental, ophthalmology, sometimes immunizations, public health, bioenvironmental engineering, which is industrial hygiene, and clinical flight medicine. And there's more administrative aspect to that than just being a straight clinic and or doc in the clinic. But the expectation for aerospace medicine specialists is that they will continue on in leadership in Air Force medicine. And so, unfortunately, in leadership roles, every step you take into the world of leadership is a step you take away from clinical medicine. And there's just no way to avoid that. But the way that I looked at that for myself was that I could have a much greater impact being a squadron commander, which runs about a third of the clinic on base, or the hospital commander, where I was running the entire medical mission for the base as I did in Afghanistan and at the Air Force Academy. I could have a much greater impact on a population of people than I could just seeing onesie-twosie patients in the clinic.
You mentioned Afghanistan, and that was certainly a pretty significant part of your military career, and you spent a big component at Bagram Air Base. How does it feel now that that's closed? Does that kind of leave you reminiscing a little bit? How do you feel about that closing down?
Oh, that's a great question. You're going to make me choke up here. So every war has to end. I mean, Afghanistan could not become the 100 years war for us. And so that was eventually going to happen. And somebody had to be the last commander there. I wasn't the last commander. But I did see, I think it was on CBS, on YouTube, a news story where one of the reporters got onto the base with the Afghan army that has it now. And they walked through the U.S. Forces headquarters building where I spent a lot of time. All the power was off, and that was a little disturbing. But then they toured my hospital. And I lived in the hospital. I lived about 20 yards from the emergency room and trauma bay and about 20 yards from the OR suite. And they walked through my fully stocked OR bay or trauma bay with no power. And that was our biggest fear, was losing power at our hospital. And then they walked through the OR, through OR1 with no power. And I found that uniquely unnerving to watch that, just because what we did at the 455th Expeditionary Medical Group, Craig Joint Theater Hospital there at Bagram Air Base, I can honestly say that is the best thing I've ever done in my life, the year that I spent there. Now, I was the hospital commander, but I was also the task force medical commander for Afghanistan. So all of the non-special forces surgical capability throughout the entire country was under my command. So all the damage control surgical teams that were out in places that nobody's ever heard of, those folks not only sent their patients to us, but they were part of my organization. And it was the greatest honor of my life to get a chance to lead those amazing, amazing medics. At least for the year that I was there, if you were going to get any kind of injury, of trauma, any kind of injury at all, Bagram is where you want to be treated, because we had the best survival rate of any trauma system in the entire world.
I remember reading about this, I guess it was called Warrior's Way, and it was kind of the path, I'm guessing, as you come in off the aircraft into the hospital and under the US flag. And it was, if you could get under that flag, 99% of people would survive. That's an incredible statistic.
Well, actually,
is that correct?
It was even better.
Okay.
It is, but it's even better than that, Ben. If a US military medic put their hands on you at any point, anywhere in the country, honestly, it was hard to die. It was more like a 99.7% survival rate. Because if we could get hold of you, we entered you into a trauma system that was absolutely a thing of beauty. It sounds terrible to describe it that way, but it was exquisite. Our surgeons out in the field could stabilize almost anything. If you survived long enough for us to get to you on a helicopter dust-off mission, you were going to make it. In fact, the year that I was there, we did not lose a single American military member or any other State Department, anything that came into our system. Once they came into the system, we didn't lose a single one. The only one few that died, and they died before the medics got to them.
So obviously the body armor and that kind of stuff is so much better than it has been in previous conflicts. But what about that operation allowed you to have such a success rate?
Well, part of it was there's the strategy of how we distributed our medical forces And then there was our knowledge that has been gained by death and blood and sweat in previous conflicts. Honestly, the one piece of equipment that was responsible for saving more lives than anything else in Afghanistan was the combat application tourniquet. It cost about $3.50. Because the number one cause of death on the battlefield is bleeding out, exsanguination. If we can stop the bleeding, you're going to make it. We're going to be able to save you. But in addition to that, talking about the strategy, we distributed our forces, both our damage control surgical teams and our dust-off units, that the helicopters that went out and picked up our patients. There was not a single U.S. military member anywhere in the country of Afghanistan that was further than a 60-minute flight where we would actually 30 minutes out from a dust-off mission. So we did not operate anywhere. Helicopter could not fly out, pick them up, and get back to surgical resuscitation within 60 minutes, called it the golden hour. And we would move our damage control surgical teams around in order to ensure that when we opened up a new area of operations. And so the strategy of that, and I inherited that, I was not responsible for that. But that strategic distribution, again, was learned through hard experience and the combination of the excellence of our medics. I mean, an Army combat medic, I put my life in their hands anywhere, anytime. One of our trauma surgeons from the Army, Air Force, Navy, anywhere. I would have them operate on me for anything, because they are absolutely amazing. But the combination of the strategic distribution, the right type of gear and the knowledge of how to use it, and the excellence of our medics and the speed at which we could move patients is why people just, it was hard to die. And I say that reservedly because I know there may be people listening to this that lost someone in Afghanistan, and no one feels that more acutely than I do. But it wasn't because it's not because there was any lack of speed or lack of skill in taking care of those patients.
Or have come back and have survived, but have some pretty significant consequences of that. But they were able to come back and live. One of the things I'd like to take a little bit of a deeper dive into is the leadership component. So when you got to Bagram, they already had a pretty good survival rate. And the old adage is the only way when you hit to the top is down. So when you got there, talk us through the environment that you were in and maybe some of the, let's not call them problems, but some of the areas of improvement that you could see. And then how did you go about implementing them so that you actually increased the survival rate of folks who could be within that range of the golden hour?
Sure. So when I arrived in Craig Joint Theater Hospital, for anyone that's associated with the military, they know that name. That is a hospital that has had an amazing reputation for literally decades, just absolutely phenomenal. And so I realized going in that it was already working really, really well. And so what I looked for were margins of excellence that I could facilitate to help the excellent become even better.
Now, granted, I like that, margins of excellence. That's a good way of putting it.
Right. And that's, think about the a rind of excellence around a piece of fruit. Okay. So I'm just trying to get just that extra millimeter or two that is just even better. Okay. And so when I got there, I assessed as well as I could the surgical care that was being provided. And I mean, there's absolutely nothing I could do to improve that. What that margin of excellence came down to, I realized, is a lesson I learned many years ago in the Air Force as a leader, which is take care of your people and they'll take care of the mission. Okay, so I set about looking to how I could best support the medics that were there everywhere, all the way from the person that is bringing food to our chow hall in the hospital to the trauma surgeons that are saving lives every hour of every day. And there were a couple of things that I saw. Our medics, they had to, so the hospital was kind of at one end of the main road in Bagram. And on the other end were all of the USO facilities were, the theater, the places where people went to decompress. We were kind of separated from that. And so I thought, why can't we have something like that on the grounds of our hospital? And so had some individuals that were interested in helping do that. So we cleared out some underbrush from the backside over near the helicopter pad and had a couple of talented people in carpentry. That's the other thing. People have talents that you don't know about until you ask.
Yeah.
Okay. And give people an opportunity to show you what they can do. So I had a couple of guys that went to our civil engineers on base and found the lumber. They drew up the plans and they built a hut out in the back that had a television built into it. It had seats and an outside railing around, had an outside porch. They built a cornhole court and a little cabana and a sand volleyball court. And they built essentially Club Med is what we called it because it was out behind our hospital. And when people weren't working, they didn't go back to their room in the dorm, in the barracks. They didn't go all the way down to the other end of the base. They went out back and they hung out together. So they worked together and they played together and they got to know each other. And if you get to know the people that you're working with, there's accountability and excellence that comes from that. So that was one thing that we did. I also noticed that there were three people that lived in the hospital itself. That was myself, my trauma czar, which is my chief trauma surgeon, and then my deputy commander of the clinical staff, who basically ran all of the medicine in the hospital. He was also a trauma surgeon. And when they were, there was no way for them to get away from work. So the only way for them to get away from work was to go into their room in the hospital, which was essentially like a cell, just with a handle on your side of the door. And they just had to sit there. And if they weren't in there, they had to be in uniform and out in the hospital. No one else had to do that. In their dorm, they had common areas in the hallways. They had a day room where they could be in their exercise gear, their PT gear, and they could relax and be away from work. And so we were going through a remodeling of part of the hospital. And so I rolled in a day room conversion for those three people that lived in the hospital. Admittedly, I was one of those, but it was something that was going to be used by every commander after me as well. It also gave us a place to bring non-injured comrades of our patients to get them away from the trauma room, trauma bay, and be able to talk to them about what was going on. So it was a multi-purpose room. But that one thing, it sounds like such a small thing, but not only did I see my two trauma surgeons having an opportunity to relax, but they knew that I cared about them because I had done this for them and it made such an impact on them. And I saw them being more relaxed just on a on a everyday basis. Did that result in one more life being saved? I don't know, but it sure didn't hurt.
Yeah.
It may not have helped, but it sure didn't hurt.
And your key people knew that you were willing to go in to bat for them.
That's right. And we had a limited amount of space. And so to do that, I had to take some space away from some other folks to make that. And this is a really important leadership lesson that you're never going to please everybody. And Lincoln said you can please all the people some of the time, some of the people all the time, but not all the people all the time. And so I had to make a decision about what was more important, knowing that I was going to pay a price for it. Very few decisions have no price to pay. But I had to weigh the cost and decide whether that was a price I wanted to pay. And in the end, it could have been a mistake. It wasn't, but it could have been. And a leader's got to live with those mistakes if they make them and own those mistakes.
This is probably a good place to talk a little bit about leadership presence. So you had a reputation. You're obviously from Austin, Texas. You're a proud Texan, descendant of a Texas Ranger.
Right.
And you had a reputation as kind of this Texas cowboy is how I've heard it described in some of the articles that I read about ahead of this interview. And you wear your pistol on your hip. Some people would give out challenge coins, but you would give out Texas Ranger stars.
Right.
Did that feed into, I guess, kind of an image or a presence that you wanted people to have when they saw you as a leader?
Yes. And this is that's a really great question, Ben. And I hope that this doesn't cause problems if people that worked for me at one point in my career hear this. But there is great utility in crafting an image that you want to present as a leader. Okay. Now, it's important that you be yourself, because if you try to be someone other than yourself, you're going to fail. Okay.
Yeah. And people can smell fakery.
And I happen to naturally be a person with a larger-than-life personality. So this was not hard for me to pull off. Here's the other thing. I've had multiple leadership roles at multiple levels of the Air Force organization. And so over time, I tried different things and things that worked. I adopted them. things that didn't work, I tried something else. And as a squadron commander, this was 10 years before I went to Afghanistan, I happened upon the idea of that Ranger Star. It's just a saddle concho that you can buy at a saddle store. Mm-hmm. And I bought those things by the hundreds. And they're with a challenge coin. You give a coin to someone, it's meaningful. They put it in their pocket or on their desk, and nobody ever sees it. Well, the saddle concho was something that I encouraged people to put on their hospital ID badge. And I said, it's a coin you can wear. So people see that you've done something that was exceptional. And the secret is you're pretty liberal about giving those things away. And there are times it's a way to reward someone where they know it and everyone else does too. So I had a story that went behind that with the Ranger Stars as well. And when I went to Afghanistan, when I interacted with Afghan army leadership, they found that exceedingly meaningful. When I told them the story of the cowboy lawmen of Texas, they all knew about Texas cowboys. And so when I told them the story, gave them the star, I had the Surgeon General of the Afghan Army actually put that on his ID badge on his uniform. And the next time I saw him, he was still wearing it. So
he's still wearing it, yeah.
He was still wearing it. And so, yes, I did. And I grew up in the Austin area, but my family's from Abilene, long history of West Texas cowboy folks. And so, yes, I adopted that persona and still hold a little bit of that now. But when I went to Afghanistan, that wasn't the extent of it. I mean, I took my cowboy hat and I wore it out around the fire pit behind the hospital, and I gave the Ranger Stars. And I did carry my pit. So everyone was required to be armed at all times in Afghanistan. And so rather than wearing my pistol on my hip like everyone else, I wore it across my hip in a cross draw, which is the way my great-great-great-granddaddy wore his. And so that kind of set me apart as well. But more importantly, when I got to Afghanistan, again, looking for that margin of excellence, I looked for things that could rally my people together, okay? And that took several forms. The first thing that I did is I kind of did this call and response. I had this motto, this med group cheer, if you will. And this is how it went. I would say, nobody dies today. And everyone else would echo, they live to fight another day. And I worked on that before I got there. My trauma surgeons helped me refine it once I got there. But basically, what I helped them understand that meant was you can't do anything about what happened yesterday. If somebody died yesterday, you got to let that go. You can't do anything about it. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. You know, we may have a mass casualty where there's nothing we can do for some patients. And that did happen. But as for today, what you do today, nobody's going to die today in this hospital. And that means our patients, and that means you, our staff as well. So that is both an encouragement and an enjoinder to ensure that you protect yourself first and you save our patients. Because if something happens to you, our patients are out of luck because there's no replacement for anybody in theater. And so that became very meaningful to my folks. And then I built on those things. Once a month, we would have a commander's call where the entire hospital got together. We'd give out awards. We would do different things. And then I would end by addressing the whole group. And I tried to make those as meaningful as I could. And I had three different rotations of airmen that deployed and then redeployed home while I was there. And in the last commander's call, right before they left, every time, I would talk about the quote from Shakespeare's Richard VIII, the one about the band of brothers.
Yes.
Right. And I told them that we have not shed blood, we have saved lives together here. And no one that wasn't here with us will ever understand what we've gone through. No one that has not been a medic at Craig Joint Theater Hospital can possibly understand what you've done. And that binds us together. That binds us together. And I'll tell you that it was not infrequent that at the end of those talks, I'd have airmen that were moved to tears. And just because it was so meaningful for all of us to be there doing this incredible thing together. And so that really is what my role was to be present and to always be the person that they expected me to be. A commander can never have a bad day. And that obviously you do have bad days. It's just that nobody around you can ever know it. And for instance, we did rounds at 7 o'clock in the morning in the ICU on all of our patients every single day. I did not participate in the care of a single patient while I was there. okay? But I did not miss rounds a single day in the 13 months that I was there. Why? Because if it was important to them, if it was important to be there, it was important for me to be there. And if I wasn't going to be there, why would I expect anybody else to be?
You're talking about some really strong leadership decisions that were made at the pinnacle of your military career. But you made a comment before that I want to go back to. You said, sometimes you're going to make good decisions. Sometimes you're going to make decisions that are less than ideal, and you have to own them. Can you walk us through a situation where maybe someone you know, in inverted commas, or if you feel more comfortable just explaining a situation where maybe things didn't go as well, and what it looks like to own a decision that's not ideal?
Yeah. So actually, I have a really good example of that. And it was in my second assignment out of residency. I was the chief of aerospace medicine at Cannon Air Force Base in Clovis, New Mexico. And I'll try to make this as short as I can, but the details are kind of important. So I had told my folks, I kept on getting messages, senior leaders on the base commander, the base deputy commander. There were four or five messages that I didn't receive, that they had called, left a message for me, and I didn't get them. And so I told my NCOIC, my enlisted leader of the clinic, I said, look, here's the rule from now on. Anytime someone calls for one of the docs, take a message on paper and it goes on their desk. And on my desk, it goes right here. And I pointed right where I wanted those messages to be, because I'd gotten chewed out pretty good for not returning some of the messages. And so I got a call one day from the deputy commander of the base, and he said, Sparky, I called you 2 days ago. I had a question about so-and-so from my wife. He said, why didn't you call me back? I said, sir, I'm sorry. Took care of the issue. And then I marched every single person in my clinic into the conference room, put them at attention. And get embarrassed just describing this because it was so bad. I stood them up at attention around the wall, and I tore them up one side and down the other. And the person that I was told took the message, I tore into her in front of everyone, especially. And when we were done, I dismissed everyone. My NCIC said, boss, come with me for a second. He walked me into my office and he lifted a stack of papers right in the place that I told him and showed me the message that was sitting on my desk. Okay. So I was tremendously embarrassed. And so I let it go for that day because I wasn't sure how to handle it. That's a good leadership lesson. If you don't know how to react, don't, because you can always react later, but you can never unring the bell. So the next morning, I brought everybody into the conference room. And it's funny, they all stood around the wall at attention. And I said, no, at ease. And I explained to them what had happened. I told them I screwed up. I made a mistake. That message is right there. And I first went to the young lady that had taken the message, and I apologized to her. I asked her for forgiveness. And then I went around to each person in the room and apologized to each person individually for the way I reacted, because not only was I wrong, but I'd handled it the wrong way, even if I'd been right. And the chief of the entire clinic, the chief of the whole medical group, the whole hospital, came into my office afterwards, and he said, I understand that you just apologized to all your enlisted troops. And I said, yeah, chief, I did. He said, you should never do that. And I said, well, I disagree. And the thing is, Ben, that I learned probably the most important leadership lesson in that event that I ever learned. And you learn most of the really important lessons by doing something wrong. That's where it really lodges and gets traction. But I learned that there is tremendous power in apology. Tremendous power. And I'm not talking about apology like our society talks about it today, apologizing for things that you may or may not have done wrong. But when you make a mistake, going to the people that were impacted by that mistake and saying, look, I messed up and I'd like to ask you forgiveness, that gains you respect that you can't get any other way. And I don't suggest people engineer an event like that so they can apologize. I know people that have tried to do that, but it gains you respect that you can't get any other way. Because here's the thing, if you make a mistake, the people affected by it know it was a mistake. If you don't say anything, it's not like you're getting away with something. Okay, but if you go back and own it, that has tremendous power.
And I'm sure as well as trust, it builds just this very deep respect.
It does, absolutely.
Let's take a turn to, I guess, the final chapter of your military career, which is where you became the first Surgeon General of the US Space Force, a brand new branch of our military. We haven't done that for decades. What was that like to be part of standing up a brand new branch?
Well, so here's the thing. We've actually been doing it all along. It just didn't have a lot of publicity. So that's a little bit different. We are doing some new things. But that story goes back to when I was in Afghanistan. I went from Afghanistan to Air Force Space Command. And so imagine this. This is about the 10th of my 13 months in Afghanistan. And I'm expecting to come out of that job into some highly relevant combat position. And my boss's boss, General Murphy, comes to Afghanistan. And he and my boss at the time tell me, congratulations, you've just been selected to be the command surgeon for Air Force Space Command. And my first thought was, and I'm embarrassed to say this because it was an amazing job. My first thought was, you've got to be kidding me. I've just gone from the most combat, fangs out, operationally relevant job, leader command job in the world, the only combat medical command in the entire Air Force, to the least operational job there is. Basically, where it's satellites and missiles. Okay, so what's the big deal with that? But I smiled, said thank you, and started getting my mindset to go and take this job. So I eventually come back, go to pick up my family in Abilene. We're driving to Colorado Springs, where Air Force Base Command headquarters was. And on the way, I hear President Trump's speech about the Space Force. And when I heard that speech, it's like, it's a new ball game now, Bubba. Things have just changed. And it took about a year and a half for us to build and get ready and actually stand up Space Force. So I took the job the 1st of August in 2018. And on December 20th of 2019, the Air Force Space Command was signed into law. And General Jay Raymond, who was my boss at the time, became the chief of space operations, had the big thing at the White House, unveiling the flag, the whole thing. I immediately became the first Surgeon General of the Space Force. It's a story about being at the right place at the right time. And for chance favors the prepared mind. And you're not always going to be placed in those great jobs, those great positions. Sometimes those things happen to you almost accidentally. And when that does, you have to be ready. You have to be prepared to take that ball and run with it. So let me tell you an example of how I did that in the Space Force. So the first meeting we had with our command staff, with General Raymond after that, he wanted to know what our thoughts were about where we were going to go now that we were the Space Force. And earlier in that meeting, one of our officers, one of our leaders had asked General Raymond, so Space Force, what is that for? Defending space? What does that mean? Is that like defending against alien invasion? And General Raymond kind of raised his eyebrows and looked at him and shrugged. It's like, if not us, who? And that blew our minds. The idea that that's really what our job could be. But that's what he was trying to do, is get us to think and dream strategically. Because he never wanted us to let what could be or what would be constrained by what is. Mm. Because today we have missiles, we have satellites. But even now, look at what's happened in the last year and a half. SpaceX has launched American astronauts on an American vehicle from American soil. Mm. And we are planning a manned mission to Mars. That's going to happen. It's going to happen in our lifetimes. In fact, a permanent presence on Mars is going to happen in our lifetimes. And so I started thinking about, what does medical have to contribute to that? Because up until now, NASA has been the exclusive purview of people going to space. And what they've done is they've prepared astronauts to go to space. But once they were there, there's not a lot of medical treatment. They're not doing surgery in space. They may administer an IV, but there's not a lot of medical treatment that goes on. If somebody has a life-threatening illness or injury, they're coming back to Earth. There's going to be a time when we won't be able to do that anymore. And so I started thinking about, what does the practice of medicine in space look like? And me and my staff kind of boiled this down to three lines of effort that we needed to be able to do before we could have an enduring presence in space. The first of those lines of effort, and I don't know, is this something you want me to go into?
Yeah, keep going. This would be really interesting.
All right. So the three lines of effort, the first one there's a current requirement for, and the other two will come in the future. But essentially, those lines of effort are, how do we do medical evacuation from Earth orbit? So how do we send an ambulance to the International Space Station? The second line of effort is, how do we do strategic patient movement between planetary orbits? So the beginning of that will be from the moon to Earth. And finally, how do we do medical and surgical resuscitation on the surface of other planets? And that's where the money is. That's going to be probably the hardest part. So the first line of effort. In talking with the folks at NASA, we actually have a pretty good plan of how to do this. It was a plan that they had kind of on the shelf in some way that was the lifeboat for the International Space Station. And it was a lift vehicle called the X-38. The X-38 is in mothballs right now with NASA. But in talking with the NASA chief medical officer and the director of the Kennedy Space Center, they said, if we're going to do a space ambulance, this is going to be it. And it's a vehicle, if anybody's ever seen the $6 million man, okay, with the Bionic Man, the beginning credits of that show shows Lee Majors in an astronaut in a crash of a space vehicle. Well, the vehicle he crashes is the X-38. Okay, so that's probably an ignominious beginning. But the X-38 is an auto-flying spacecraft that can seat eight astronauts inside the fuselage. If we remove four of those seats, we can place a floor-loaded litter, which is how we do medical evacuation in Afghanistan, let's say. We can place a floor-loaded litter in place of those four seats, which leaves space for a three-person medical team and one astronaut pilot in case they need to take over and actually pilot the vehicle. The problem is the airlock for this vehicle is on the top. And so if you're in zero gravity, you have somebody with a bad injury, somebody on a spinal isolation board, you can float them into the spacecraft and load them. But once you get on the ground, it's going to be much more difficult to get them out. So that's one of the problems that we have to think about. But if you think about if you're in Mule Shoe, Texas, okay, tiny little town on the way to Del Rio from San Antonio, the only ambulances in town live at the hospital. And yes, they do have a hospital in Mule Shoe. And if somebody has a problem, the ambulance leaves the hospital, goes and picks them up and brings them back. But if you go to Houston, you certainly have ambulances all over the city that are posted up that are not at the hospital. So when does space go from being Mule Shoe to Houston? In other words, when do we, this X-38 space ambulance, for lack of a better term, initially we're going to have it ready to launch to send to the ISS, but it's going to live on Earth. But when do we get enough people in space doing enough things for enough time that we send it to the ISS to wait for an injury to happen? Okay. So we don't have answers to a lot of these questions. We're just trying to figure out what questions to ask. Okay. So these are the questions we're figuring out to ask. So that's the first thing we have to figure out. The second thing is strategic patient transport between planetary orbits. So when we launch the Orion mission to Mars, it's not going to launch from Earth. It's going to launch from a lunar orbiting space station called the Lunar Gateway. And the way we'll do that, if you think about the size of the rockets and the amount of propulsion we have to lift things off the Earth out of the atmosphere, we don't want to waste rocket fuel going to Mars, landing on Mars, lifting off from Mars, and coming back by having to get out of Earth's atmosphere. So what we'll do is we will launch the Mars lander, the habitation module that they'll live in on the 9-month trip to Mars and back, and the rocket that will send them there and bring them back. Those will be payload that will be launched into space, sent to the Lunar Gateway orbiter, and assembled on orbit. So what we're talking about is an industrial environment around the moon. So in any industrial environment, you're going to have industrial accidents. So what happens to an astronaut if they get their leg pinched between two large things that are being assembled and they break their femur, they break their thigh bone?
Yeah.
We cannot wait to treat that until they get back to Earth, because just going from the moon to Earth orbit is a 2 to 3 day trip. And then you have to deorbit them back to Earth and then get them to the hospital. So we got to do something in space. Doing surgery in zero gravity, that's a really bad idea. Okay. Think about if you're doing abdominal surgery in zero gravity and you open up the abdomen, you got a lot of stuff in there. Okay.
Yeah.
You've got blood, you've got intestines, you've got things, and they're just going to float up and out into the environment. So that's not doable. We have to have some level of gravity to be able to do surgical intrusion into the body. So that means the surface of a planet. First place we're going to do that is the moon. The moon is not only to support the lunar gateway, but also to practice for Mars. Okay, so, but the thing is, let's go back to that second line of effort. If somebody gets really sick or injured in orbit around the moon, we've got to move them, not just as an astronaut, but as a patient, back to Earth orbit and then deorbit them in the X-38 to get them to a hospital. So if you're flying in a helicopter just to go somewhere, it's a lot different than flying as a patient that has a bad injury or illness. That's the difference between a transport and a medical evacuation. So the way that we will likely do that is configure the Orion habitation module and fly that as essentially a hospital ship, for lack of a better term, for that 2 to 3 day flight from the moon back to Earth orbit. And then we'll transload them to the X-38 and then deorbit them to the Earth. So that's probably one of the easier problems that we have to solve. The problem becomes when it's not moon to Earth, but Mars to the moon or Mars to Earth.
Yeah.
That's a 9-month mission one way. So at that point, we're not looking at a medevac mission. We're looking at a Navy hospital ship equivalent for space. We've got to be able to treat them all the way back. And the further we get away from Earth, the less likely we are to actually move patients back to Earth. So when we get to Mars, if somebody gets hurt, somebody gets sick, we've got to treat them and return them to duty there at Mars. We can't afford to bring them all the way back. So that brings us to the third line of effort, which is medical and surgical resuscitation on other planets. So to do surgery, you have to have some level of gravity. The moon has 17% Earth's gravity. The Mars is about 1/3 Earth's gravity. And that's enough. Both of those is enough. It's enough to keep, when the astronauts on the moon jumped, they didn't keep going. They eventually came back down.
Came back down.
Okay.
Yeah.
So blood and other things may be a little bit easier to liberate into the environment, but it will eventually settle. So it doesn't hang around in the environment. Now, we'll probably have to have a different kind of surgical environment, maybe an enclosing bubble that the surgeons work in, intrusion gloves. But when you talk about medical care, this goes back to the basic tenets of aerospace medicine, normal physiology in an abnormal environment. The space shuttle. So we live in 14 PSI pressure every day on Earth, unless you live in Colorado, and then it's a little bit less. But on the space shuttle was 10 PSI. I believe that's correct. My NASA colleagues may correct me on that, but it's around 10 PSI. The spacesuits that the astronauts do an extravehicular activity in are 5 PSI. Okay, so we're used to having some work done in lower than regular pressure than we have here on Earth. The problem is going back to your chemistry, Dalton's law says that the total pressure of a gas is equal to the sum of the partial pressures of the individual gases in that solution. And so if you have a lower total pressure, that means your oxygen pressure is going to be lower. And when oxygen pressure gets low, your body has a hard time oxygenating all of your tissues. If you don't oxygenate all your tissues, you can't heal. Okay, so this really has an impact on healing and medical care off-world. And so we are most likely going to have to build a pressure vessel that our medical will have to be in a pressure vessel that gets to about 14 PSI. So the larger the differential between the outside pressure and the inside pressure, the more expensive and the more chunky that pressure vessel has to be, right? So those are problems we have to solve. The other things we have to think about are it's really expensive to move payload into space. During the Apollo missions, one of the astronauts wanted to take some things with him on space mission and asked the aeronautical engineer, said, what is the weight limit for things that we're going to take into space? He said, here's the rule. Whatever you want to take with you, go outside, throw it up in the air. If it comes back down, it's too heavy. Okay, so they were really restricted. It's really expensive to get payload into space. Now, think about an operating room. Think about an ICU. All of the equipment, all of the medications, all of the supplies. It's going to be very difficult for us to completely stock a medical unit on the moon, much less Mars. So we've got to figure out how we're going to do that. And one of the ways that we're thinking about right now is 3D printing. So it's going to be very difficult to print an anesthesia machine on a 3D printer. But you can print replacement parts for an anesthesia machine on a 3D printer. There is a medical unit led by Dr. John Ho at the Uniformed Services University of Health Sciences that has printed red blood cells on a 3D bioprinter. And the FDA is currently evaluating them. They may have already completed this, but last I heard, they were evaluating them to make sure they functioned as red blood cells.
Wow.
This opens up a whole new world for us. Imagine printing organs, printing replacement tissues, printing medications. I mean, red blood cells by themselves. My blood bank at Bagram, we had to brought in blood products from the United States, but we also had established a walking blood bank. So if we, for instance, we had one trauma patient that came in and required, before he finished in the trauma bay and in the OR, we put 250 units of blood product through this patient. And he survived.
Wow.
He's alive today. But that, I mean, we had to call the walking blood bank and draw blood from people, from soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines on the base that we then administered to this patient. Okay. Not going to have that many people on the moon or Mars. Okay. So walking blood bank doesn't work. But imagine if you could print red blood cells, put them on the shelf. You could print them with no antigens, so no problems with crossing and tight matching. Put them on the shelf. When they expire, you disintegrate them back into the slurry and you print them again. That is revolutionary.
It's mind-blowing.
That would revolutionize care on Earth as well. Think about being able to do that in the Horn of Africa, places that are underserved medically. West Texas, for goodness sake. So, and beyond that, my pharmacy was a third of my entire building at Bagram. Imagine, instead of keeping medications on hand, if you printed the molecular structures of medication when you needed them. So you literally printed medication, administered it to the patient. All you have to do is come up with the materials for the substrate for the 3D printers. And that's a lot easier problem to solve than how you take 1,000 pill bottles to Mars.
That is just fascinating. That is just fascinating. And I think for anyone listening, there is a lot to be interested in and excited about when it comes to not just the practice of medicine, but in particular, as you say, medicine, what would you say? It was normal physiology in an abnormal environment.
Right, right. Let me say one more thing, Ben. Okay.
Yeah, please do.
I always end my talks about space medicine with this. For anyone that's interested in going into medicine, being a physician that's out there or being a nurse, the first trauma surgeon, emergency medicine physician, and trauma and critical care nurse that will receive deployment orders to the moon are in college or medical school today. Today.
Yeah.
Is it going to be you? Is it going to be you? Are you going to be the first to go? Somebody has to. Might as well be you.
And if you are, that means you're listening to the Professionist podcast. So that's the first great decision you've made. You're on the right path.
Absolutely.
Colonel Matthews, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure to have you here on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Ben. It's been a true pleasure talking with you.